Podcasting from baseball heaven, St. Louis, Missouri, home to float trips, gooey butter cake, and the Gateway Arch. This is the Navigate the Rapids podcast, where you find out how to effectively run and market your business. And now, here's your host, Will Hanke.
Hello, and welcome to Navigate the Rapids, the show where we help business owners run and market their business online. My name is Will Hanke. I'm the owner of Red Canoe Media. And today we're talking about pricing, a topic that a lot of business owners don't put a lot of thought into when they're setting up their business. My guest is Dale Furtwängler. Dale helps his clients get higher prices regardless of what their competitors or the economy are doing. He's the author of an internationally acclaimed book, Pricing for Profit, which I highly recommend, and I'll actually link to in the show notes today as well. Dale, thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Will.
Oh, no problem. So how in the world did you get into the business of pricing?
Well, actually, I stumbled into it. I started my business as a part-time CFO because that's my background. I'm a CPA by background, and it lent itself to that. And inevitably, when I'd go into a new client and look at their financials and ask them, well, what's making money and what isn't, they shrug and they go, I don't really know. Right. And they were being honest. Their systems weren't set up to tell them that. And when I do the analysis, what I'd find is that the greatest investment in marketing dollars and production capacity were all in the least profitable lines they had. And they'd say, well, that's my primary business. You know, can we raise prices? And I'd show them how to raise prices. And that's really how I got into it.
Oh, isn't that interesting? So did they typically take you up on the let's raise prices thing or no?
Yeah, the vast majority of the time, because they were asking for it at that point. You know, the ones that were fearful, you know, that were afraid that their competitors, they'd lose business to their competitors, never asked the question. So the ones that were asking were already wanting to do that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Why do business owners struggle with pricing in the first place?
Well, they don't have a frame of reference. You know, it's not something that's taught. You know, even in marketing programs in universities, pricing is one element, and it's probably the one that gets the least attention in the whole process. So part of it is because we've never been taught to do it.
Right.
Number two is that unless you have a finance background, you haven't been taught to quantify the value, to convert benefits into dollars and cents value, and consequently you struggle with that. So it's, you know, it's a combination of those two things. And really there's a third, and that is not being clear about what it is you're really selling, what that value is.
Well, that makes sense. I think even from high school, we're not really taught a whole lot about finances in the first place. You know, it's kind of a thing that's just pushed away and not, you know, typically brought up a lot.
No, it doesn't. And it's unfortunate because we deal with finances on a daily basis, whether we're business owners or not. You know, we've got personal income, we've got to budget our expenditures, we've got to make investments for the future, and we're not really taught how to do that.
Yeah, just another hat to wear, right?
Right. You know, it's like, go figure it out on your own. You know, I mean, it's sad, but that's what's really happening.
Yeah. Yeah. So what is it that you think customers are really buying?
Well, you know, there are really only three things that customers buy. And this is contrary to the way most business owners think, because when we present our offerings to our customers, you know, we've got a lot of benefits that we claim to provide. But in reality, there are only three things that customers are buying: image, innovation, and time savings. That's okay. It. You can take any benefit that any product or service claims to provide to a customer, and it's going to fit into one of those three categories. And once we understand that and we reframe our marketing along those lines, we are going to attract more customers because that's really what they want. And it's also going to be easier to price because we can get a sense for the value much more readily when we focus on one of those three areas.
That makes sense. So is a exercise for a business owner, the first thing to do is to figure out what your products are and which of those they fit into?
Yes. Yeah. Take a look at the benefits and see whether those are really translating into time savings, or it's because you're innovative and you're leading the market in terms of new approaches with a product or service that you're offering, or whether it's image enhancement, and it can be some combination of those as well.
Oh, okay. Okay. That's interesting. So how about for physical products, things that people just need, you know, let's say for a further house or something like that, would that be under typically the time savings?
Well, it could be. It could be, you know, if, you know, one of my clients, one of their lines of business was doing asphalt driveway sealing.
Okay.
So that's a service. You know, so for a lot of people, that's convenience. That's time savings. And right. So when we look at it from the standpoint of time savings, then what we can discern is how much is that person willing to pay for that? And if we know the market that we're serving and the income levels of the people in that market, as long as we're charging less than what they would make on an hourly basis, they're probably going to buy.
Right.
If we exceed that, what they get paid on an hourly basis, then they're going to consider doing it themselves.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how typically come up with this?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Oh, I said, how do business owners typically come up with their pricing in the first place?
Well, most of them use their competitors as a frame of reference. And because they don't know any other way to do it. So they look at what their competitors are charging, and typically they try to beat their competitors' pricing, thinking that's going to give them an advantage in the marketplace.
Right. I'd say that's pretty normal.
Yeah, it's normal, but it really hurts the business.
Sure.
Yeah. It hurts the business because one of the things it does is it diminishes the value, the perception of value in the customer's mind, because we're trained to, from young people on, to equate value and price.
Right.
And to give you an example, I did a program for an optimist group, and I was talking about this point, and a woman in the audience said, "Well, you couldn't be more right." She said, "I've got a 10-year-old. This is 10 years old, right? Okay. I've got a 10-year-old who's saving her money for a used iPad. And periodically she goes out on the internet to look for, to see what the price are, to see how close she's getting with her savings. And the other day she went out there and saw an iPad and said, oh, there's got to be something wrong with it. That price is really low. No point looking at that. So 10 years old, she already recognized that value-price connection.
Interesting.
Huh. And so when we go out and we make lofty claims, and albeit they're accurate claims about how our products are superior, or our offerings, if it's service offerings, are superior, and then we price at or below the industry average, we confuse the buyer.
Right.
And we really undercut the claims that we just made.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned that most business owners look at their competitors. Are there other ways that they come up with their pricing?
Yeah, really the way you should come up with pricing is on the basis of value. How much value does it have to that particular customer or customer group? So if we go back to our three elements, image, innovation, and time savings, let's take a look at image. If if I want a sweater, I can go to Walmart and get one for $10.
Okay, yeah.
If I go to Nordstrom's, it's $120 to $140.
Right.
Okay, so there's a premium for image. And so if we know where on the spectrum from Walmart to Target to JCPenney's to Macy's to Nordstrom, where on that spectrum we want to be, then we get a good sense for what value image has to that buyer. So let's say that I'm a chocolatier just getting started, and I want to provide a good quality chocolate, but I want to do it at an affordable price.
Right.
Then looking at that spectrum in retail, at the sweater example, well, I know that a $10 sweater at Walmart is probably going to be $12 to $15 at Target. It's going to be $30 to $40 at Penny's. it's going to be 60 to 80 at Macy's, and it's going to be 120, 140 at Nordstrom. Well, if I'm wanting to be a good quality but affordable, I'm probably targeting the JCPenney type buyer. Well, that tells me then, because Penney's gets $30 to $40 for a sweater where Walmart only gets $10, that I can probably get 3 to 4 times the lowest priced chocolate in the market.
Oh, okay.
So that tells us how to value image and gives us a way to do pricing off of that.
Okay.
If we're looking at innovation, you know, we can look at prior innovative products and see what kind of premiums they got in the early stages. So if we look at VCRs and DVRs, you know, the initial ones that came out were simply players. They weren't even recording devices at that point, and the technology wasn't very good. And yet those innovation buyers were paying $1,200 to $1,400 for that player.
Okay, yeah, we see them, people standing in line at the Apple store.
Right, yeah, absolutely. And you know, but the mass market would get in somewhere around $400.
Right.
So roughly a third.
Yeah.
And then the late adopters, the people that didn't buy DVRs until they weren't putting movies on VHS tapes anymore, would get in at $85 to $100. So we can, again, look at the cycle and what kind of premiums are gotten at each stage, and we can get a sense from that about how much premium we can charge on the front.
Oh,
and the time savings we already discussed, if we know the market we're selling to and what their hourly rate of compensation is, we can pretty get a pretty good sense for how much they're willing to pay for that convenience.
Yeah, okay. Well, that definitely makes sense. Do you know the, kind of surprising this on you, do you know the amount of people that are early adopters versus mass, you know, the mass market area versus the, you know, is that information available somewhere?
It is available. And in fact, it's in some of my books, and I don't remember specifically which ones, but the early adopters, if I remember correctly, represent about 2.5% of the market.
Okay.
And then what they call the innovators, who are people that are more visionary. The earliest adopters are simply interested in the latest and greatest. They just want to be on the cutting edge of learning what's new, whether or not there's a practical application for it. The second group, the innovator group, are more visionaries that see something new and see applications for it earlier than most people do.
Sure.
And so that's, I think, about 13.5% of the market. And then you get into the early majority, which is about 34% of the market, and they will only get in once the innovators have proven that that practical application they're seeing is actually working and providing some benefit.
Okay.
And those, so those would be the ones that would be paying $400 for the VCR or DVR.
Okay, so even that latter stage of people are still considered in that first round of pricing.
Right, yeah. So if you look, it's kind of like a bell-shaped curve.
Okay.
You got the early adopters, the innovators, the early majority, then you got the late majority, and there are a couple beyond that, the final one being the late adopters. But, you know, the second half of that bell curve is not where the money is.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so you want to be on the front end of that whole cycle.
Yeah. That makes sense. So kind of bringing this all back to online, you know, how do we portray our price being higher versus somebody else who, you know, a competitor who has a lower price but the exact same value?
The exact same value?
Well, perceived, I guess. You know, if I'm up against a competitor and we both offer the same services, why would one be higher than the other? How do we portray that online?
Well, you do that through your positioning statements, your marketing messages. So you have to distinguish your offering in a way that has value to the customer. And the good news is that the vast majority of businesses really don't communicate their value very effectively.
Right.
And they tend to speak generically. So, you know, if I'm a pricing guy and I talk about being a pricing guy, and there are three other pricing guys in the St. Louis area, and they all talk about being pricing guys, we're going to look like commodities.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So when I talked about pricing, and one of the reasons I created my brand promise the way that I did, and said that I'm going to help you get higher prices regardless of what your competitors or the economy are doing, there isn't anybody else out there making that claim.
Yeah. And if you can, if you can back it up with the,
you've got to be able to back it up, but you can distinguish yourself that simply by being more clear about what the person's going to get, what result they're going to get. Because a lot of businesses in their taglines and their marketing messages talk about what they do and not the result that the customer is going to get from using their product or service. So just that simple adjustment in your marketing approach and your brand promise are going to differentiate you very effectively. And when people get a sense that, yeah, that's what I want, and you're more specific about it than everybody else out there, you've just distinguished yourself in a way that has value. And if you frame your messages along the lines of either, you know, to approach their image needs or desires, or their innovation desires, or their convenience desires, again, you're going to distinguish yourself because your competitors are not framing their messages that way.
Yeah, I think that's a huge thing that a lot of business owners miss, especially when they're building their sites. And, you know, we need to list all of our services and all the things that we do, you know, and that's fine. But that's how all the verbiage comes across as well. Here's what we can do.
Yeah. And, you know, part of that in terms of effective marketing is creating your marketing messages so that you're excluding people who don't fit. You know, so when I was touting a leadership program that I had, there was only one type of leader that program was designed for. And so my marketing message spoke specifically to their view of management. You know, so if, okay. It was, my message was, if you're the kind of manager that likes to engage your employees and streamlining processes, identifying new opportunities and solving problems, and you'd like to get results like this, and I had exceptional results to tout, then give me a call. Well, managers who weren't of that ilk, you know, the autocrats and the paternalists and the leadership, looked at my ad and said, well, this guy's a bleeping idiot. I'm not going to buy from him. I'm not going to call him. Well, that's fine, because they would never buy my service anyway.
Yeah.
So, and a lot of business owners fear excluding people from their market. Right. But that's the most effective use of time and marketing dollars.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got a friend that says some of the best clients I ever had are the ones I never got, because, you know, he realized how much of a pain in the butt they would have been, you know, or outside of what he really wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of business owners get stuck in that, you know, we need the money or we need the clients and we'll take the work, even though it's kind of outside of our realm.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, there isn't a business owner alive that can't relate a story or two about the nightmare customer, you know, the one that no matter what you did, you couldn't satisfy. And, you know, it cost you a bloody fortune to serve them.
Yeah. 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 So let's talk a little bit more about getting premium pricing. What's involved in making that happen?
There are really five elements to getting premium pricing. There's the brand promise, which we spoke about just a moment ago, being clear about the result that the customer is going to get. And so let me give you an example there to help you understand how that works. Because okay. A clear brand promise does three things. It communicates result very quickly and effectively. It begs the question, how do you do that? Because then the people give you permission to tell them more. And then it lays the groundwork for benefit statements in the sales call. So one of my clients is an ergonomic equipment manufacturer, and they buy the lifting units and they customize the gripping systems for the application for that particular customer.
Okay.
So the tagline we came up with, a brand promise, if you will, was leveraging the power of man. And so they would get asked, well, how do you do that? Well, we buy the core unit and we customize the gripping applications for your particular business. And then in the sales call, they could say, we leverage the power man physically and fiscally. Physically, they're going to be able to move more product more quickly, more safely, which is going to increase productivity, which means that you can handle more sales without adding to your workforce, which falls right to the bottom line. Oh, by the way, your experience amount on your workers' compensation insurance is going to go down because you're not going to have people out injured. Right. And the mistakes that get made when somebody's filling in for somebody that's been injured, those go away. So you start building such a compelling value proposition that people just say, all right, enough, enough. Just, you know, where do I sign? So that's the first element, is that brand promise.
Yeah, that's interesting. So do you physically, well, maybe not physically, but do you, I mean, for me, I would probably put that into Word and, you know, kind of stage out the script, I guess you could call it. You know, where they, how do you do that, you know, is part of the way that you represent yourself.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That gets scripted.
Yeah. I like that.
So when I'm working with clients, you know, they not only get the tagline, which is the brand promise, but they also get a script to use when they're networking to be able to communicate that effectively.
Oh, that's super. That's really cool.
Yeah. Then the second element's identifying who the ideal customer is. Okay. And with that, I do psychographic profiling. I teach people, or help them get a vision of who their ideal customer is, not on the basis of demographics, but on the basis of psychographics. And to give you an example that will illustrate the difference between the two, Will, let's assume that you own a Mercedes dealership. Okay. And you know that all of your customers have six-figure incomes and they live in certain zip codes. Now, that's demographics, and it's accurate. But what it doesn't do is explain why there are people in those zip codes with six-figure incomes who are buying Hummers and Audis and BMWs and Lexus. So the psychographic profile gets to the question of why are they buying?
Oh, interesting. Okay.
What values, what behaviors, what characteristics can we identify that are going to tell us that this is the right customer for us? And what we find is that with a good psychographic profile, that within one question, typically, and no salesperson, good salesperson uses just one question to qualify, but within one question, you can probably on a 90-95% accuracy basis, identify whether or not that prospect is a good prospect for you. And the follow-up questions will affirm that initial impression. And so it shortens your sales cycle, and it helps you avoid wasting a lot of time, and more importantly, the energy that gets drained from you when you're trying to sell to somebody that's just not a good fit.
Yeah. Yeah. I just had a client tell me the other day that he spent 20 minutes with a customer and then they got around to listening and she's like, oh, I can afford about 1/5 of that. So, you know, yeah. had he had the right questions in the right place, probably wouldn't have happened that way.
Right. Right. So the psychographic profile is the second element. The brand promise is the first. The third element then, and this is kind of a natural outgrowth of the first two, is the positioning statement. Now that we know what it is, who that customer is, what it is they value, and what result they're looking for, makes it a lot easier to frame your marketing message, your positioning statement, so that you can attract people who want that, and they want it enough that they're willing to pay a premium price in good times or bad.
Oh, yeah, okay. Can you give us an example of that?
Yeah, you know, if you, with my business, I had a leadership program.
Okay.
And when I originally, you know, I had some phenomenal results with this management system that I used when I was in corporate. In fact, the most dramatic result I got was in one employment. My staff and I cut 16,000 hours out of a 40,000 hour budget. So 40% improvement in productivity. We were constantly improving things as we went along. The morale was higher than it had ever been. Yeah. I mean, my turnover rate was virtually zero. And when I got into business for myself, I coached one of my clients on this system. She was having trouble getting the billing out on time. In fact, it would take her 3 weeks to get the billing out after project was complete. Within a month, they cut that from 3 weeks to 2 days.
Oh, wow.
So I had some phenomenal results, and I was out marketing those results, and I got a lot of interest, as you can imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
But my close rate was abysmal.
Oh.
And I couldn't figure out why. You know, who wouldn't want results like this is the question that kept coming to mind. And right. When I got serious about answering that, what I realized was there were three types of managers. There were autocrats who viewed employees as automatons. You know, you key in the instructions, flip a switch, and they better darn well do what they're told.
Right.
There are paternalists who, for some reason, feel a responsibility to hire people who aren't necessarily top tier. And, you know, consequently, they don't expect a lot of them. And then the third is the engagement manager, the one that likes to engage their employees in identifying new opportunities, streamlining processes, and solving problems. So, you know, my program was designed for the third group. So yeah. When I recast my marketing message, instead of leading with the results, I said, if you're the type of manager that likes to, and I described the engagement manager, and you'd like to get results like this. Well, I just changed my marketing so that I excluded the autocrats and the paternalists.
Oh, and because of that, your close rate went up because you were talking to the
went through the roof. Because the people that called already knew that that style of management worked for them. I didn't have to educate them on it. I didn't have to convince them that that was going to work. The only difference was it worked for them, but they weren't getting the level of results that I was getting.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's what they wanted.
Okay. So that's number three. Did you say
that's
were five?
That's number three. So the brand promise, the psychographic profile of the ideal customer, the positioning statement. The fourth are sales scripts.
Okay.
And we talked earlier about the fact that business owners haven't been taught how to convert benefits into dollars and cents value. Well, that's what these sales scripts are designed to do. I actually develop a series of questions for my clients that lead their customers through a calculation of value so that when that value is determined, the customer is buying into it or the prospect's buying into it because they were part of that calculation. So again, okay. To give you an example of how that works, I was talking to a bank subsidiary about a training program, in fact, that leadership program that I just mentioned. And the VP of HR said, well, I like the program. And he said, I just don't think we're ready for it. And I said, well, why not? And he said, well, we've got a morale problem. I said, well, tell me about that. Maybe I can help you with that. So he tells me about the morale problem. I said, okay, now you didn't say that you were losing customers. So how's the work getting done?
Right.
He said, well, he said, we got people working overtime. So how much are you spending for that? And he looked and he said, $85,000 a year. And I said, do you use any temporary help? Yeah. How much are you spending for that? He looks, $40,000 a year.
Oh, wow.
I said, well, if everybody showed up to work and they just worked at current capacity, no improvement in productivity at all, would you need that? He said, no. I said, so if we solve your morale problem, we're going to save you $125,000 a year.
And he goes, right.
Yeah. Yeah. But I led him through the calculation. He was part of doing that calculation. And so he believed the numbers because he saw it himself.
Yeah. He told you the numbers. You didn't make them up.
Right. Right. So that's what I'm talking about with a sales script. I create a series of questions that my clients use in the sales call to lead their customers or their prospects through that calculation of value. And that gives them a sense then for how much they can charge for that particular engagement.
Right. Right. You know? I've been on the other end of one of those calls where, you know, they lead you down the path and it's really hard to say no once you've kind of gave them all the right answers and the indications that you're ready to buy.
It's hard to say no, but if they do say no, you just realize you're not dealing with the right person.
Yeah.
I mean, I talked to a guy one time, and I knew I could save him $250,000, and we went through the calculation, and I was going to charge him $70,000 for that, and he said it was too expensive. It's like, okay, oh. Well, you know, see ya, because, you know, if you think a 3-to-1, more than 3-to-1 return isn't adequate, then I'm talking to the wrong person.
Yeah. Wow. That's kind of crazy.
Yeah. But I mean, there are business people out there that look just at the cost side, and they don't, you know, for whatever reason, they don't believe that it's possible to achieve that kind of return. And they don't do it.
So in your script, is that something that you try to work on filtering them out before going all the way through it?
Yes. Yeah. You know, yeah, I typically don't get into the money at first because I'm looking at whether or not that they fit the profile first in the sales call. Yeah. And if they fit the profile, then the odds are they'll find the money for it. Some people like to start with the money. That's okay. But I think that as soon as you start focusing on price, well, let me restate this. I think that when you start too early in the process with the price, it's more difficult to tell whether the prospect is a price buyer or a value buyer.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Because when I talk to, and I think that's an easy way to tell, because if I'm talking about value and I'm a value seller, if I'm talking about value and that prospect keeps asking me, well, what's it going to cost? What's it going to cost? And they haven't gotten a clear picture of the value yet. I'm probably talking to a price buyer, and they're not going to be a good customer for me anyway.
Yeah.
And I can, as soon as that happens, you know, the first time I'll try to postpone it. If it comes up again earlier than it should, then I start to back away.
Yeah. Yeah. So with the sales script, once again, is that something that you, first of all, that you help the customers create?
I actually create them for the customers, and then we'll tweak it so that it fits their language and their style. But yeah, I craft all that.
And then if they have a sales force, is that something that you help kind of teach them all how to do it or go through it?
Right. Yeah. We can train the sales force on how to use that. And frankly, you know, with the psychographic profile, one of the things I've discovered is that psychographic profile will have some common elements for every salesperson, but it can be different as well for every salesperson.
Oh,
so if you and I are both selling the same product for the same company, and your background has been with Fortune 500 companies and mine has been with smaller businesses, that psychographic profile, you know, where we should be devoting our time and energy in selling should be different.
Oh, that makes sense, because you're able to communicate with that audience a lot better.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm going to speak their language. You're going to speak the language of the Fortune 500, and you're going to have the experience of knowing the language they typically use, who in the organization's the economic buyer, and those sorts of things. So you're going to be a lot more effective. So actually, even though people within the same company are selling, they could each have an ideal customer. One salesperson might have a lot of experience in manufacturing and another in IT. And yet whatever you're offering, whether it's a product or service, could fit both markets. Well, yeah. Then for the IT guy to try to sell into the manufacturing market, it's ludicrous.
Yeah, it makes sense. You might as well sell to who you're comfortable with. And like you said, you speak the language.
Yeah. I mean, just increase your odds.
Yeah.
You know, life is a game of probabilities. You know, when you go with the strongest probability, you're going to enjoy the greatest success.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's a good quote. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. So we've got four elements now. We've got the brand promise, the psychographic profile of the ideal customer. We've got the positioning statement and the sales scripts. And then the fifth element is pricing and bundling.
Okay.
And so here we actually create three bundles of offerings to afford three different budget levels, if you will. And then I teach them, you know, we price each of those. And that's the pricing's pretty easy at that point because you've determined the value. Their questions will have determined the value.
Sure.
So they know how to set the prices for each of those three options at that point. But one of the things I teach them, and again, we give them the language for this, is how to present those three offerings so that they increase their average ticket sale and produce a better result for their customers.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Those are the five elements. And what I found is that if any one or more of those five are missing or not congruent, then you're going to confuse the buyer and they're going to revert to price.
Yeah.
If all five are in place, then price doesn't matter. It really doesn't.
That's pretty awesome. So all five steps are things that you can help XYZ company with.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. And tell me a little bit about the book Pricing for Profit.
Well, the book has a lot of these things in it. I didn't go as in-depth, I don't think, with the psychographic profile as I probably could today because hopefully we all learn and grow, right?
Right.
But, in the Pricing for Profit book, you know, I talk about the image, the innovation, the time savings. I give formulas in there or ways, approaches for pricing for each of those. Examples on how to determine whether or not the person fits or which category they're predominantly interested in. We develop the sales scripts in there. And we do it for industries that are, you know, people would view as pretty much commodity type businesses, you know. And what I tell people in the book is that there are a lot of commodity products.
Right.
But very few commodity businesses. In other words, there are very few businesses in which we can't add value in some way that we can't dramatically increase the value to the customer, even though we may be selling the same product.
Yeah. And I think using those as examples is a great way to get your point across as well, that, you know, even though everybody's buying this whatever commodity, that there are still ways to improve it.
Right. Right. Yeah. So it's, the book does cover the vast majority of those five elements, you know, how to price, how to bundle, how to present that way that's going to increase your average ticket sale.
Okay. And is that available on Amazon?
It's on Amazon. Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's just in paperback now. I don't think they're printing the hard copy anymore, but I did have the good fortune, if anybody's literate in Chinese, it's been translated into Chinese.
Oh, really? Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. Huh.
And do you also have the downloadable Kindle version?
Yeah, I believe there's a Kindle version as well at Amazon. The publisher takes care of those things. So once I get finished writing, they take care of that stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's a great book. I read it a while back, and I probably need to go visit it again. I think I probably will. So you also have a new book out. Tell us about that one.
Well, yeah, I've got a new book out, and this came about in part because of the pricing work that I've done. You know, one of the things that customers have said consistently, every customer has told me exactly the same thing when we've gotten finished with the pricing project. They said that they've gotten so clear about who their ideal customer is, what it is they value, and how much they value it, that they've gotten confidence to the point that they are able to say no to customers and feel very good about it, you know.
Okay.
And, you know, so that confidence thing, plus in the last 18 months or so, I've had over a half a dozen people say to me, I want your life. And when I challenged them on that, they'd say, well, I want to be able to do what I want to do when I want to do it like you do. Or I want to be able to take advantage of opportunities and not worry about the consequences the way you do. Or I want to take more time off to travel and not worry about the money the way you do. Well, what they were really saying is they want to be free of fear, anxiety, and frustration. And so when I looked back at how I had gotten to that stage in my life, I was able to come up with that. So, and I found it all traced back to confidence. So I extended this confidence element that from the pricing area into other aspects of people's lives, other aspects of their business, as well as their careers or personal lives. And so the book is entitled Lead a Life of Confidence, Free Yourself of Fear, Anxiety, and Frustration.
Wow, that sounds awesome. And I'm going to ask the same questions again. It's available on Amazon.
Yes, it's on Amazon and it's in Kindle version.
All right. Oh, that's terrific. Well, thank you very much for being on the show today. You shared some spectacular things about pricing.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me, Will. It's been fun.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. So stick around. I'm going to ask you a couple more questions for our elite members. Now, if you're not a Red Canoe elite member, then I highly encourage you to join. You can just go to redcanoemedia.com/elite, and you can see all the interviews that we've done, plus all the bonus segments as well. And Dale, I appreciate it. Stick around. We'll ask a couple more questions.